Hello, I'm Simon Lambert, the editor of This Is Money, and this podcast is the fifth episode in the Making the Money Work series, sponsored by FSCS. On these shows, I join host Andy Peters and a fascinating range of guests with unconventional lives and finances to find out how they make their money work. The episodes will be arriving in your usual This Is Money podcast feed. We hope you enjoy listening to them and learning about some lives less ordinary. This week, we speak to comedian Shappy Khorsandi.
This podcast is brought to you in association with the Financial Services Compensation Scheme. Check your financial products are FSCS protected. Visit fscs.org.uk/thisismoney to find out more. Hello and welcome to the final episode in the first series of Making the Money Work. Over the course of this series, we've been delving into the inspiring lives of high-profile people who have rejected the 9-to-5 routine and embraced a unique career path. Is that you, madam?
I think so. Hi.
Hallelujah. Not your turn yet. Got to introduce Simon first. With us, as always, is our financial guru and expert, Simon.
Hi, Andy.
Thanks, Simon. Today, Simon and I are joined by a genuine living legend. Hello, legend.
Hello.
Hello. Our living legend is a bastion of British comedy. She's a TV, radio and stand-up comedian who's not only written a novel and a memoir, but continues to support worthy charitable causes through her work. Shappy Khorsandi, welcome.
Hello, Andy.
How are you?
I'm very well, thank you.
Looking resplendent in leopard print.
It's my first leopard print. I'm very excited.
Oh, first leopard print of the season?
Of ever, in my whole life.
Really?
Yeah.
It's very on brand, though, you know.
Thank you. I hope so. Well, I just thought I'm at a leopard print age.
I work on Lorraine. I know what's on trend and what's not.
Oh, I love
yellow
that.
Is the colour for next year.
Yellow doesn't suit my skin colour at all because I've got a lot of yellow pigmentation in my skin. So yellow, I just look like a daffodil.
No, you say that, but some people say I'm ginger, they can't wear red. Oh, wear red as a ginger.
Yeah. Well, I was a life model for many years and the teachers would always go around saying, notice the yellow hue of the model's skin.
Very on trend.
I want to go on Lorraine now and wear it.
You should. Lorraine would love you.
Yeah, I've been on her show before and I just wore the wrong outfit. I need to go on with this dress.
Yeah, I think, genuinely, leopard print always works on television. Simon, at this point, has no idea what we're talking about because he only ever wears white formal shirts.
How do you feel about leopard print, Simon?
I don't know whether I'd wear it personally.
No.
I do have a sort of sheepskin flying jacket, though, that used to belong to my dad in the 70s, I've had for years and is called The Animal because the collar on it is absolutely huge. And I read something the other day where it said that sheepskin is now back in fashion this year. So I was like, wow, if you hold on to something for long enough, it goes around in circles about four times.
Exactly. Well, if you hold on to your money long enough, hopefully you should make money if you put it in the right place. And that's why you is here.
That is true.
Because you know all about money.
Yep.
Why?
Well, because I'm a financial journalist. I'm the editor of the This Is Money website and I'm on This Is Money podcast.
And one of the reasons we're here, Shappy, is to talk about money and how money's affected your life.
Yes.
Which, when I read up all about you, you've had the most fascinating life story. This podcast, no podcast could be long enough. I don't think in my entire 30-year broadcasting career I've ever had a question written for me that read like this. What do you remember about fleeing the Islamic Revolution? I mean, I normally get, Kylie, tell me about your new single. I mean, you know, old school, I might say, what's your favourite Weetabix? Or, you know, but this is ridiculous.
I can tell you about Kylie's new single if you like.
In no that problem. Dress, you could be Kylie. But you've got a really broad portfolio of work that you've done. So you've obviously had you've been earning money from a young age, but you were a cleaner at one stage.
I was.
A life model.
For a long time, I was a cleaner and life model.
What is a life model?
Well, you stand naked.
Oh, it's
and,
that?
Yeah, and art students draw you. So I've worked in art colleges all over London.
So many people have seen you naked?
Many people, yes. That's why when I was on I'm a Celebrity and everyone was getting really bashful in the shower, I was like, well, you can't really wash unless you take your clothes off.
Right.
Because I just think it's a body.
Yeah, and we've all got one.
We've all got one. And I think doing nude life modelling as a young woman helped me enormously with my confidence because, you know, I had so many hang-ups and issues. You're really respected by the artists. You know, you are in a position of comfort and power. It's not like, you know, sitting in a pub naked.
Yeah.
That would be an entirely different experience and possibly illegal.
Not in the pubs I go to.
Can I go out drinking with you?
Just putting it out there, you know.
And so I did life modelling before I did stand-up, and it really helped me to get the courage to do stand-up, because I think the more things you do to shed your fear, the easier you're able to do things that you find scary.
And was that just a necessity to make money that you did life modelling?
I don't do well in 9-to-5 jobs, in structured positions. I got a job in an office once and they asked me to fax something, and the fax machine, I didn't know how to work it, and I got into a right fluster. I don't like having a boss.
Right.
It's not because I'm, you know, I want to be the boss. I just quietly like to do my own thing.
And if
you're a cleaner, you can put your headphones on, you can listen to the radio, you can daydream. I am a massive daydreamer. And so I found with life modelling and cleaning, I could daydream.
In the million jobs you've done,
yeah,
you've worked in a prep, you worked in a call centre, and you actually hired Alan Carr.
I did hire Alan Carr. So that was after university, and loads of people in this call centre were working at creative jobs. And then I was helping them with interviewing new callers, and Alan Carr walked in. And he went, "Oh, I'm sweaty, Betty, darling. Get me a glass of water, would you?" And I thought, that's so confident to come into an interview and say what you need. I need a glass of water. And then I listened into his conversation. He was calling for a charity. I think it was WaterAid. So he was completely off script. And he went, "Well, there's this one village we work in where they only had one bucket of clean water, and then this great big stinking ox stuck his head in it. £20 a month, thank you very much." And I said to him, you should be a comedian, you're really funny. And he went, "Oh, that's the plan."
Amazing.
There we go.
Do you save money lots?
No.
No.
So I didn't have any money. We didn't have any money growing up. My dad's a poet in exile. So if you imagine how much a poet makes, now put him in exile in a country where people don't speak his language. And then when I knew I was going to do stand-up comedy, and I was paying the rent through cleaning and life modelling, so there's no room really to save after you've paid your rent. And in my 20s, I saw all my friends go travelling and have dinner parties when they cooked lots of fancy things, and I was still sort of scrabbling around. And then in my mid-30s, it was soon after having a baby, that my financial situation changed, and I started to make money, proper money, savings going up.
And was that was presumably in kind of big lump sums rather than a steady income being your job,
yeah,
what it is?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I did Live at the Apollo, and I did all these like television jobs, then I started touring, and I had been in debt up until I was about 32, 33, and I wasn't used to seeing my money in the black. And for a long time, I couldn't get my head around it. It felt like the money that I was making from my work was money I had won, rather than actually you've been grafting for 12 years, lady. You've been grafting this. You have not pulled this out of a hat. So I had this bizarre thing that I would like just give it away. I would give it away. I had a boyfriend who needed to £8,000. It turned out it was £8,000 to see his other girlfriend in Australia. Let it go.
£8,000 to Australia? You can do that for $649.
I didn't even question it. It was a strange time in my life. And it was really odd. And then I spoke to other comedian friends of mine who acknowledge that it's the same for all of us. We're all skint for ages, and then you make it and you've got money and you have to respect it. I really had to talk to a lot of people about how I deserved it, how I'd earned it, and my attitude towards it had to really change, because I would have frittered it away. And now when I see young comedians come up, I sort of think, oh, you know, your bank balance would have gone from minus to plus. And I don't know, Simon, you can correct me here if I'm wrong, but I just look at them and I think, buy property.
Well, I don't know. I mean, if you'd have bought property 20 years ago, then that's definitely true. But property was cheap 20 years ago, whereas property now isn't so cheap.
Right.
But also, there's not many places where you can effectively buy an investment gradually over 25 or 30 years, which is essentially what a house is. And then when you come to retire, you're lucky enough that you don't have to be paying rent to someone.
I'm with you. Buy property, because that's what I did. So I was very lucky from a very early age to be earning money, because I've been doing television since I was 18.
Yeah.
So that was my thing. I was like, well, I don't know what else to do.
Yeah.
And I didn't have someone to give £8,000 so they could go to Australia. And I bought a car. I bought a Range Rover, and it cost £70,000. And in my head, it was like buying property. it'll always be worth £70,000.
No.
So when I came to sell it 3 years later, I got like 25,000.
Wow.
So I thought, I'm never buying a car again outright. I'll just always lease cars.
Mm.
You're right. The depreciation on new cars is huge. So it basically, as a general rule of thumb, you will lose about 30% of a new car's value over the first 3 years. And when you do one of these PCP deals, you take it out over 3 years or 4 years. And effectively what you're doing is you're just paying the depreciation. And then at the end of it, you don't own the car. You can
give the car back or get
give,
a new
give
car.
The car
yeah.
back.
Yeah.
But yeah, cars lose money. And that's an interesting thing, actually, about the whole saving and investing thing. Because people get the whole buy property. I understand property. Mm. You know, buy land. They don't make it anymore and all that. They get the whole put some money into a savings account. Because that's great. I get my interest rate return and it's safe. My money's protected in case my bank goes bust by the FSCS up to £85,000. But then when it comes to investing, people are like, oh, yeah, but I don't know about that. It's too complicated. I mean, start opening an investment account and investing into a really simple fund that invests around the world is definitely easier than buying a house.
Right.
And also people say, oh, but I'd be gambling with my money. I don't want to lose money. But at the same time, people will say, I don't want to lose money. But they'll happily go lose a third of the value of a car over the first 3 years.
But didn't your financial advisor tell you to buy a house with a spare room so you could rent out the spare room?
Yeah.
I think that's quite smart, actually. If you're buying somewhere and you're a little bit worried about whether your income might not quite cover it, I mean, that's the classic thing for self-employed people, isn't it? Really worrying about where's the next gig coming from. That if you do have that backup of being able to rent out a room or something, that's a really nice safety net.
That was a really important thing to me. I imagine that when my children have grown and left home, I'll be like Mrs. Madrigal in Tales of the City. Do you remember?
Yeah, I know what you mean.
I just want lots of really interesting people to come and live with me and I'll go around making them tea.
My Irish grandmother, she lived in Welwyn Garden City. She had an Iranian lodger.
Well, we rented a flat in a big sort of Victorian house. So we had a two-bedroom flat, my family, that we rented, and we had a constant stream of visitors from Iran. And what happened was, during the Iran-Iraq war, people would come here to pay for private medical care, and to save them money, you would host them. So we'd get a call saying, there's a little girl, she's 5 years old, she has cancer, she's coming to London. So her and her parents lived with us for nearly a year, because otherwise they wouldn't be able to afford the hospital bills. It's really interesting, you said your mum's Irish.
My mum's mum, yeah.
A lot of Irish people I know are quite similar to Iranians in their sort of open door policy of people coming to stay. And, oh, yes, we had people come to stay all the time.
I think African people are the same. It's very much, okay, open the door, someone's coming to stay, and they'll stay until they finish staying.
Yeah.
Whereas if someone's coming to stay with me, there's a 7-page contract, and the day you're meant to be leaving is the day you're meant to be leaving.
Yeah.
And there's none of this, can I have a late checkout? The checkout is when I'm going to work that day. If I'm leaving at 4:30, I'm leaving at 4:30, and so are you. That's just the way it is.
My home needs to not be chaotic. I work very hard on having a mellow home life because I've got two kids and I work and I support them on my own. I think that's another big reality that hit me. I divorced, and then 6 years later, I had my daughter by myself and I get no financial help. So I steer quite a big ship on my own financially. And that is never a situation I thought I'd be able to cope with. Somehow I've managed to.
Yeah, well, and to be a single parent of two children and work in entertainment, it must feel quite pressurizing at some times. But then do you take a moment sometimes to think, well, I got into this and I'm still in it. I must be doing something right.
I love my work so much. I can't see myself doing anything else. And I think with the internet nowadays, you can find your own audience. You know, you might not be rich, but you can keep things ticking over if that's what you want, I think.
And you prefer not having any help? Is that something you're quite well adjusted to now? It's, I'm going to do it my way.
I didn't do it consciously, but I don't think it's an accident. Mm-hmm. I went on a date recently with a guy who is like a multi-millionaire, and I've never dated anyone who's wealthy. And he actually said, what's your issue with men with money? It was very smart of him to pick up on it. But I was like, oh my goodness, you're right. I've never, ever been out with a man who earns more than me. And that's not because I'm earning like millions and millions. When I was a kid, it was just impressed upon me that you are financially independent. Because when you are financially independent, you can walk away from a situation you're not happy with. When I was 15, I went on a date and my dad gave me money. And he said, whatever happens, you pay for that pizza. He sort of made me pay for my own meal and the meal of the guy, this poor kid. I might have taken it a bit too far. I'd quite like to be taken out to dinner now. Now I'm thinking, please, can someone buy me pizza? But I took it quite far. And I think that my parents were so keen for me as a woman to understand that money means choice. I just have an innate trust that I'll be okay because I have had no money and I've had, you know, to eat Weetabix and banana for my dinner. And I've been okay. I've survived it. And obviously with children, that's not where you want to be. I'm not saying that, hey, anyone can cope. But for me personally, I know that I've made a choice to go into the most precarious job. And when I had no money with a newborn baby, my daughter, it was because I bought a house. Let's not forget. It's because I bought the house that I, you know, will have forever. And I just had to have a moment in my kitchen and say, I literally don't have the money for the mortgage next month. And then a call came through from my agent saying, are you breastfeeding? My baby was 6 weeks old, 9 weeks old. And I said, depends. How much? And he went, okay, it's 4 days in South Africa. And so I gave my baby to my mum and I went to South Africa for 4 days for a corporate job, which sorted me out for like the next 4 months.
Amazing.
And I say to my children, like, if you want to do a job that's unusual, you have to be a risk taker.
Simon, do you find those people are normally smarter with their money?
I think quite often they get thrown into it. And to begin with, they'll make mistakes like deciding that they shouldn't have all this money in their bank account. They're just going to give it away like you did. But I do think that they do get smarter with their money and they start to realise and they become quite cautious. They'll salt it away. I'll meet lots of entrepreneurs, for example, who have left jobs to go start up their own business. But you get the sense when you're talking to them, they're also sticking some money in savings because they know that at some point, they've always got that little doubt about the success.
Yeah.
They enjoy the success, but they go, well, it could go wrong at some point, and I don't want to lose it all. And where it's really interesting is when you talk to people who have become entrepreneurs later in life after they've got more responsibilities, you know, so they might have a family or something like that. Because it's easy to do when you're 22, 23 years old, and it doesn't matter. But once you're, you know, in your 30s, you've got a couple of kids or something, you worry about how you're going to pay the bills.
When I run around doing all the things that make me money, you know, the corporate work that I do, that eats time away from my creative work. So I thought, well, the bank's going to be my partner then.
Yeah,
and
there
I've,
we are.
Yeah, I've married my house. And for 2 years, I'm having a bit of a step back from rushing, earning, you know, whatever I can and saying yes to everything and sort of getting alone and giving myself breathing space. And so I guess that's a risk as well.
Yeah, and you've invested in yourself in a funny sort of way to hope that what happens in 2 years has a return.
Yes.
And you make money from it. That when you broke into the London comedy scene as a lady of colour, were you quite lonely?
I do remember just the fact that there were so few women.
Yeah.
So few women that you don't get put on the same bill as each other, so then you don't really meet. But now it's so different. There's such a big support network of women in comedy and get-togethers and friendships. And I feel that I really missed out on a lot of friendships that I'm having now, which is great, but I'm like 10 years older than everybody. The being of colour thing, what I found quite difficult that I've only really realised now is that because everyone's got diversity quotas to fill, they sort of will you to do stuff about your ethnicity. So the first script I wrote for Radio 4 was about being a life model, and it came back with one note. We were rather hoping she'd write something about her Iranian background. So they immediately scrapped that idea. And then at the age of, well, how old was I? 24. I thought, oh, okay. So in order for my stuff to be bought, in order for me to be allowed in, I've got to do stuff about my Iranian background. And I feel that I hung myself a bit by a hook because now that I don't do that stuff, it's like, oh, no, we've got people doing normal stuff. Could you be brown, please? it's still happening because there are younger, you know, non-white comedians coming up. I mean, it's brilliant what they're doing, but they, after they have finished talking about their ethnicity and their background, because as a comic, you talk about what you know and who you are. I want to see them be developed, being allowed to do whatever they want to do, and that being commissioned.
It's funny you say that, because I'm even just thinking of auditions on things like Britain's Got Talent or whatever, and you think, oh yeah, once the comedian is of colour, that whole set has to be about their colour.
Yeah.
Sorry, you've just opened a can of worms in my head.
Yeah, it is kind of tricky, and that's sort of perpetuated by the very white producers.
Yes, precisely.
And the very white commissioners and the gatekeepers. It's like Lenny Henry said, it's not good enough having an Asian family on EastEnders. We have to give the gatekeepers diversity. I won't mention its name, but there's a successful sitcom on TV. I noticed it was an all-white cast, all-white writers. And then I got called in to do, said, oh, would you come into a writer's session? I was like, oh, how wonderful. And I went in to go to a writer's session and I looked at the other person who they'd also asked to come into the writer's session. And it was another Asian comedian. And I was like, all right, they've called in the brown people because they've had criticism. The cavalry's arrived and then now they have a non-white character.
It's all a bit topsy-turvy.
It's all a bit topsy-turvy.
It's a bit weird.
I want to be a commissioner.
Really?
Yeah.
I've done that job.
I know you have.
Yeah.
I've always watched your career because that was my dream, to be a kids' TV presenter.
Oh, really?
So, oh, absolutely. I went to school with Connie Huck. I'm over it now.
Oh, blimey.
Yeah, that was my dream job. So when you talk about making money from the age of 18, I remember going for auditions then, and there's a part of me that's thankful that I didn't, because I was such a wreckhead in my 20s. If someone had given me money, I don't think I would have lived to be 46.
Ah.
I would have, like, eaten it.
I was just a bit of a geek, so I had this really funny thing. I just wanted to save as much money as I could.
Yeah.
I just literally had to say, I want to get my bank account to be the biggest number I've ever seen.
Amazing.
And that's what I did. And my branch of my bank, do you remember where my branch was?
It's NatWest, Andy, isn't it?
No, TSB.
Oh, was it?
I was at TSB in Streatham.
Yep.
And they also did piggy banks and stuff. And I literally just saved and saved and saved until this poor bank manager in Streatham went, I think you need to change banks, because, yeah, and I lived at home.
Wow.
I was happily living at home. And also, I think
the Sinead with Coots.
Yeah.
Are you? So you wanted to be rich?
Well, I'm really weird. I just wanted to save as much money as I could to see what it's like, just to keep saving. And my parents let me live for free, so I just thought, I'll just keep saving to see what number I can get to.
You see, because that's only just kicked in for me now. Like, so the way I was raised, my father's a socialist and he lives and breathes his socialism still. And so I would get asked to do babysitting when I was a teenager by, you know, really wealthy families.
Yeah.
And my dad would go, don't accept money. Do it as a favour. It's like, it's a noble thing to help a family out with a young child by not accepting the money. And also being Iranian, right? So when you go out for a meal with Iranians and the bill comes, everyone's like, I'll get this, I'll get this. No, I'll get this. So you have to fight.
Yeah.
For the bill. And so I went to university and I went, we'd go for curry like at 1 a.m. Guys, I'll get this. Oh, cheers, Shappy.
And where was the fight?
I got in so much debt.
And then you'd be sitting there the next time you went out thinking, oh, it's all right, someone else will say, I'll get this
time.
And
they don't. And actually, that my first term, a couple of my friends from university came to visit my parents' house. And my friend Stephen went, oh my God, you're poor.
No.
Seriously? He went, I just thought like you were like really rich. I was like, no, mate. It's my instinct to say I'll pay.
Yeah.
I find it very interesting talking to people who make money about their attitude towards money, because it's so different to mine. So I learn from people who manage money for a living. It's really interesting.
And because of your two children and your upbringing and you're being a single parent, what financial planning are you doing for them?
I'm just working really, really hard. I'm just trusting that I'll raise them well enough for them to be able to confidently go out and make their own way and, you know, be able to come home whenever. That's a really crucial thing living in London. They can yo-yo back and forth to my place, which I will love. They will probably hate. But that's, I don't know how I would have been a comedian and been skint for as long as I was had it not been for the safety net of my parents letting me stay at their place.
Time's almost up. One quick question. You did I'm a Celebrity, Get Me Out of Here. Was that an experience you enjoyed? Because that would have brought you a big check.
It did.
Okay, there we go. Simon, what should she have done with that check?
Cashed it.
Okay, thanks.
And put it somewhere nice and safe. Don't give the money away.
Yeah,
it's your money.
Do you know what I did? Do you know what I did with the money? I tell people how much I got paid. I got paid a year's worth of bedtimes with my children. Oh. So that's what I did with my I'm a Celebrity.
What was your favourite moment in I'm a Celebrity and what was your worst moment in I'm a Celebrity?
My favourite moment in I'm a Celebrity was when my name was called to leave.
Okay, and where do you, where
first,
were you?
First.
Really?
Yes, okay. My mum said you were released early for good behaviour. Do you know what? It's not even just my children I missed. I missed you and I missed Simon. I just missed anyone on the outside world that you can have eye contact with and share a human moment with, because in there, the cameras are on you the whole time, so you can't share a thought process with somebody. I've never felt so like you're not part of the gang as I did there, because... it was really tricky.
So you did it for the check?
Yes, I did.
But actually, that check gave you a massive reward, as you say, of a year
time
of bedtimes with the children.
Yeah.
So. And is that how you evaluate taking some jobs? What will it give me in my life?
100%. The way I look at... Right, I should have said this at the top. The way I look at money that isn't made from my creative endeavours, like writing or comedy, I look at money as how many bedtimes... does that give me with my kids? Because I make my money pounding the streets at night. I go to theatres, I tour. But if I do a job that's not stand-up or writing, it's time with children. And that is the be-all, end-all for me of what money means.
We could talk for hours, genuinely.
I never stop talking.
But thank you so much for coming on. I hope you've learnt a little bit about finances as well.
Absolutely. Well, like I said, I'm on a journey at the moment where I'm embracing it, whereas before I was a bit like, la, 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 don't talk to me about money. But now I'm like, no, let's talk about money. Because, you know, you've got to be a grown-up about it.
Okay. And there's one sitting right with us. Simon, thanks very much. Always a pleasure.
Thank you very much.
See you for Series 2.
Series 2, hopefully.
No, never say hopefully. Just make them commit. See you for Series 2.
See you for Series 2.
At least 25% increase on our fees.
See you for Series 2 then.
That's how we do it.
Well done, chaps.
Thanks for listening to Making the Money Work, brought to you by the Financial Services Compensation Scheme and This Is Money.